The Vintage Gamer, show number 14, Mule.
This show is a member of Goblin, the gaming broadcast network, gbncom.com.
Hello and welcome to The Vintage Gamer, the podcast that seeks out great games from an earlier era. I'm your host, Jim Van Verth. The Vintage Gamer is a podcast available via RSS or direct download at www.thevintagegamer.net. It's been a busy few weeks here in the Vintage Gamer corporate headquarters. Hockey season is pretty much over as far as I'm concerned, after taking some abuse from some Caniacs at Game 2 of the Conference Finals. I decided that rooting for the Canes this season is not in my cards. I'm a Sabres fan at heart, despite living down here. So, my family and I are enjoying baseball now. Yes, the Durham Bulls kind of suck this year, but it's still fun to sit and eat hot dogs and watch a baseball game. And it's cheaper than hockey tickets, that's for sure. What else? Mer and I did do a trip to Balticon, along with Jason Adams of the Random Signal podcast. And there we met up with a lot of other podcasters. From the Southeast, there was Steve Ely, T. Morris, Jared Axelrod, which I guess is from, he's not quite from the Southeast, but, and then there's J.R. Blackwell, Rich Siegfried, Earl Newton, and, have I forgotten? Oh, yeah, Paul Martha Fisher of the Balticon podcast. A number of those people and I got together and did a not quite as well organized as we hoped, but still energetic and enjoyable production of Lancelot Biggs' Spaceman, adapted by the lovely and talented Mer Lafferty. We'll be putting together a more polished version of that online. I should say, actually, that Paul and Martha will be organizing that, and I think they'll be releasing that via the Balticon podcast. I'll let you know when that's available. Let's see, what else? I'm not sure if I'll be getting another podcast out before Origins, but in case I don't, I will be attending and participating in the gaming podcast panel at Origins on Saturday at, I think it's at 3 p.m. Paul Tevis of Have Games Will Travel will be there, as well as Tom and Joe of the Dice Tower. It should be fun, so if you're there, I hope you'll show up. And let's see, speaking of other podcasting panels, later in the show you'll hear an ad for the podcasting track at DragonCon, as well as the Parsec Awards. If you're interested in participating in such a track at DragonCon, I strongly suggest you check out the site www.parsecawards.com. That will point you to the forums where discussion of the possible podcasting panels, that's fun to say, the possible podcasting panels is going on. There are already tentative plans for a gaming panel, so if you're interested, join in. And that's more than just board games, card games, and role-playing games. We might consider video games as well. And if there's more people and more interest, maybe we can start up a separate video gaming panel. We'll see what happens. And finally, I did get my copy of the Oxford History of Board Games, so I will be reading that and doing a review at some point. So that's about it for news right now. I will be back right after this with some classic computer gaming goodness.
Firepoint Media, in conjunction with DragonCon, America's largest multimedia popular arts convention, presents Podcasting Now and Beyond, a celebration of portable media programming bringing together the full spectrum of podcasters and their audience, from pros to first-timers, for a conference of information and entertainment. Join us for panels, seminars, workshops, and events culminating in the Parsec Awards, honoring podcasting excellence and speculative fiction. Visit our website at www.parsecawards.com to join us in podcasting history. Podcasting Now and Beyond, September 1st through 4th at the DragonCon Convention in Atlanta, Georgia. Your future to the power of beyond.
MULE, or just Mule, was first published in 1983 by Electronic Arts, for the Atari 400/800 system. For those who don't know, the Atari 400 and 800 was a home computer system built to compete with the Apple II, Apple III line of computers. The Apple II and III would be replaced in the next year by the Macintosh, which was actually my first computer. The game itself, Mule, was later ported to the Commodore 64, also a home computer, and the Nintendo Entertainment System, or NES, which is not a home computer, and also that's a lousy port of the game. Mule was originally designed by Dan Bunton of Ozark Softscape. He later went on to design the adventure games Seven Cities of Gold and Heart of Africa, more classics, and then moved into more multiplayer games. He was ahead of his time, though, since modems weren't really in widespread use at the time, and so the games didn't sell very well. His last game, I think this was his last game, was 1992's Global Conquest, which was the first four-player internet game from a major publisher. And after that, he drifted out of active participation in the game industry for a while. Later, he underwent sex assignment surgery and became Danielle Bunton Berry, so you may see references to the game designer under her name, or just Danny Bunton. In 1997, she started to make a comeback with a keynote speech at the Computer Game Developers Conference and plans to create a new version of Mule that ran over the internet. Unfortunately, years of smoking led to her death of lung cancer before those plans could be completed, and no new official version of Mule has been created. However, her dream is partially met, as you can now play Mule over LANs and the internet using emulators, and there are a few clones out there as well. The concept of Mule is based on a Robert Heinlein book, Time Enough for Love. The players are a group of colonists dropped by a ship on the planet Irata, which is Atari spelled backwards, who are both trying to build the colony and make a solid stake for themselves. The primary unit used to build the colony is the multiple-use labor element, or just mule. Players buy mules, put them to work tending the land and producing various resources. And after a period of time, the ship returns. If the colony is self-reliant, or if the colony has produced enough goods, basically, then the most successful player wins. Otherwise, everyone loses. So a balance between blinkered self-interest, in other words, trying to increase your personal value, and cooperation, trying to increase the value of the colony, is needed to win the game. Now, those of you who have played some sort of Euro game designed in the past 10 years will recognize the dynamic I'm about to describe. At its heart, Mule is a resource management game. I suppose you could say this is also true of real-time strategy games. But as you'll see, there is a lot more similarity with board games here. The resources you are managing are smith ore, which is used to produce mules, energy, which is used to run mules, food, which is used to provide, I think, energy for you, and finally Christite, which is only in the tournament version and is built around pure profit. Think California Gold Rush. So, if you run out of smith ore, the store can't build mules. If you run out of energy, your mules can't produce enough resources. If you run out of food, then you'll end up having less time to perform your actions on your turn. So, keeping a good balance of resources allows you to keep your works humming and allows you to continue growing and producing. The game begins by each player picking a color and a race. Two races of note are the beginner race, which gives the player additional cash, and the humans, which is an expert race and removes cash from the player. And this is a way of handicapping the game. If, you know, some player is new, then they could play the beginner race and the more expert players could play the humans. Some other races, there are the Bonzoid, which is sort of a, well, it's an ape, like bedtime for Bonzo, and the Legite. These guys are slower and faster, respectively. I'm not sure what other benefits and disadvantages are given to counteract that, but that's the stuff that I noticed there. I haven't played enough to see how the other races work, so I can't really comment on those guys. I do know that no one really plays the mechanoids, as that's the computer race. So after you choose your color and race, the mothership drops you on the planet, and gameplay begins. The first stage of a turn is the land grab. A map display comes up, showing a 9x5 grid with a black square in the center representing the town. Now, running north to south through the middle of the board, not including the town, are four squares with a river. Now, the other squares, there are mountain icons that are randomly placed, with 0 to 3 per square. During the land grab phase, a black outline, or basically a cursor, moves across from left to right and top to bottom and resting briefly on each unoccupied square. And if you hit your joystick button at the right time, you take control of the selected piece of land. On ties, the poor player gets the land. And in this turn, you can only grab one piece of land. So if you screw up and grab the wrong one, well, you're stuck with it. You can't try to get another one. Now, there is a way out of this, which I will describe in a bit. After the land grab, there is the potential of a land auction. And this is only in the standard and the tournament games. And in this case, up to two random available grid squares can be auctioned off to the highest bidder. This auction is a bit different from your standard auction, like you might see in the board game Modern Art, for example. Rather than go around and turn and place bids, the players essentially race little dudes representing themselves up the screen. The player highest on the screen will dictate the price. This player can move down the screen to lower the price, and if they drop low enough, or another player moves high enough, then that player becomes the highest bidder. As with the land grab, the poorer player wins ties if two players are at the same level. Now, through all of this, a timer is running. When it runs out, the current highest bidder gets the land. So the dynamic is rather different from other auctions, you might see. Instead of bumping up the bids incrementally, going around the table, you are basically trying to trick players into committing higher and higher by running up the screen. And then suddenly you drop down and stick them with the land at an inflated price as the timer runs out. Normally you do that just by kind of bidding up, and if you make the bid and no one else bids, then you're stuck with it. In this case, you just want to get down fast enough before the timer runs out. Another part of the different strategy here is, in a normal auction, you would probably make a rather large bid and hope that no one else tries to outbid you. In this case, you have to race ahead to grab the land and hope that the other players can't keep up. I'm not entirely sure I've explained this well, but you really have to try it out to fully understand it. After the land grab, each player in turn can now purchase mules and develop their land. The order is from richest to poorest player. And I guess I haven't really defined what a poor or rich player is. This is calculated based on the value of the land owned, the total amount of money that the player has, and the resources that the player controls. And this is all summed up and given a little total, which you can see periodically throughout the game. So, anyway, land development is done in real time, and each player has a certain amount of time to get his or her turn done. If a player had a shortage of food in the previous turn, this time is decreased. I think that it's cut in half, but I'm not exactly sure. But it's definitely quite short. You start your turn by clicking your joystick button to indicate that you're ready to go, and your little dude starts off in the town. Generally, your first step is to purchase a mule and prep it to work one of your plots of land. The cost of the mule will depend on the stockpile of smith ore in the store. If the supply is low, the mules will be rare and more expensive. There may even be no mules available. If the supply is high, then mules will be common and cheap. So if you want cheap mules, then you'll want to sell smith ore to the store when you can. On the other hand, if you hold out, the price of smith ore will skyrocket. But I'll come to that in a little bit. So let's for now assume that a mule is available and that you have the funds to buy it. You move your little dude into a box with mules in it, which is basically the mule store, pull one out, and then lead it to one of four other boxes on the screen, which represent various outfitting stations. These can outfit the mule to develop one of the four different kinds of resources on a plot of land. So you put it there, after a period of time, it gets outfitted, and then you take your dude and you run with the mule off out of the town and across the landscape to the plot of land that you want to develop. There you carefully place your dude on top of an icon of a little house in the land, and then click the joystick button. This will place the mule on your land, and the mule will be ready to work. Now, if you miss, the mule will run away. Also, if you run out of time, your mule will run away. In either case, the other players will laugh at you, even the computer ones. If you do think you're going to run out of time, you can take the mule back to the store and dump it back into the mule depot to get your money back.
You must be listening to the Goblin Broadcast Network at gbn.com. Amazing!
Now, that sets up a plot of land for development. Choosing which plot of land to develop in which way is important. First of all, certain types of land produce more resources of one type than another. For example, river plots are good for food. Mountain plots are good for smith ore. And more little mountain icons on the plot indicate that they will produce more ore. Empty plots are good for energy. Energy is represented by a little dish collector. Christite is a little different. It's not indicated on the map by a visible icon. Instead, you need to pay the store to do an assay of the land to know whether it will produce or not. This requires that you go into town, move into the assay space. It will then tell you to run out to the plot you want to go check. So you run out there, you click the joystick button to get a soil sample, and then run back to the assay space and drop off the soil sample. This does eat up precious time on your turn, but it is important for determining on which spaces you want to build Christite mines. There's a little diagram in the manual that shows that a Christite, if you find an area with high Christite, then you'll want to build around it as well, because then there'll be like medium amounts of Christite around that. Another thing which affects production and a plot of land is what the neighboring plots have in terms of what they're developing. So if two plots of land are producing the same resource, then they each produce one more. This is based on the principle of economies of scale. If you have a production line set up, it's cheaper to set up a new one nearby. In addition, if you have at least three plots of land producing the same resources, no matter where they are, they all produce one more. This is based on the learning curve theory of production, where if you do the same thing over and over again, you get better at it. So, specializing and grouping land can really pay off, rather than trying to diversify too much and spreading yourself across the map. One other thing you can do with mules is to re-outfit them to develop a different kind of resource. You can run out to one of your plots of land, pick up a mule, bring it back to the store, take it to one of the outfitting areas, re-outfit it, and then run it back to the original plot. Or you can take it to a new one if you like. Finally, you can try to hunt the Wampus. I think it's Wampus. I've also seen it's like hunting the Wampus by taking a mule out to the mountains. I haven't successfully done this yet, but I understand you can get $100 to $400 by doing this. Part of the strategy is in the mountains, there's a little flashing light. You know, that's where the Wampus's cave is. Sorry, the Wampus's cave is. So you take your mule out there and try to hunt there. Beyond outfitting mules, there are three other things you can do at the store. I've already mentioned assaying land. You can also sell land, and this acts similarly to the auction, but this time the seller doesn't move up the screen when he moves his joystick. His asking price just moves up and down. Again, the buyers can run up the screen to try and jack up the final selling price to force other players to pay top dollar. But, of course, the seller can keep moving up the selling price, too, to, again, force the other players to pay top dollar. When the timer runs out, the player with the highest bid above the seller's asking price gets the land. Presumably, the seller doesn't want to go too high, because then no one will buy the land. So, there's a little back and forth there. The final step of the store is usually to go to the pub. There, you can win money gambling. You always win money. The amount is determined by the time you have left at the end of the turn, which is another incentive for finishing quickly. And that's your turn. It's actually a lot simpler than I've explained here. I've gone through pretty much everything you can do. It's just that there's a lot to think about in a short amount of time. Usually, you just outfit a mule to develop the land you've just obtained in the land grab, and maybe you'll outfit a second mule to develop any land that you obtained in a land auction. And then you'll just finish off with some gambling to get a few extra bucks. Oh, one thing I forgot to mention is that there are also events that can happen on your turn and other people's turns as well. These can be good things, like a windfall of money, or bad things like all of your mules breaking down. In my short time of play, it seems like the windfalls benefit the poorer players more, and the bad things hit the richer players. I hope this is the case, because this does seem to balance out the game a little bit. There can also be global events like planet quakes, which disrupt mining, and acid rainstorms, which can disrupt your food production. These affect everyone, and, as I indicated, affect which kinds of goods are produced. There are also some pirates that show up, and they will steal smith ore and christite. This comes into play with your strategy. As I'll explain later, the food and the energy kind of, they can spoil, so you don't want to stockpile them too long. The same is true with the christite and the ore. If you stockpile them too long, well, the pirates might steal them all. So you want to time your stockpiling accordingly. After everyone has done their development turn, the next stage is production and auctions for each of the resources. The order is smith ore, christite, food, and then energy. The first part is on the screen. There is a bar graph showing the amount of a particular resource each player has, with the actual numeric value below. The first step in the production for, at least for food and energy, is to consume that resource to run the mules for that turn. After that, there's also a spoilage factor, which I just mentioned, which knocks down large values of food and energy. And, as I mentioned, this cuts back on stockpiling. As this happens, the bar graphs will drop accordingly, make a little sad little pew noise. Then, in all cases, the plots produce their resources, raising the bar graphs and making a happy little whoop noise. Finally, for the consumable resources, again, food and energy, a line is drawn on each bar showing the amount needed by each player to support their part of the colony. If the line is above the top of that player's bar, then they have a shortage, which will cause them problems. If it's below, then there's a surplus. This gives each player a sense of how they're doing in resource production. Now they have the opportunity to auction off the particular good to the other players and or the store. First, they choose whether they are going to buy or sell. They can only do one or the other during the auction. Then the actual auction starts. The interface is similar to the land auction, except that the store's buying and selling price are also up on the screen as well. Sellers start at the store selling price and move down the screen to a minimum of the store's buying price. Buyers start at the buying price and move up. Where a buyer and seller meet, a transaction starts. So the dynamic is similar to the land sale. A seller will want to cajole a buyer ever higher so they can maximize their profit. A buyer will want to get the seller to come down. And if you're short on a resource, you'll be basically racing to whoever can get it to you, whether it's store or player. Obviously, you're going to want to try to buy it from a player because their price will probably be lower than the store. On the other hand, you are giving money to another player. Note that you can't depend on getting a resource from the store. If no one sells to the store and everybody just buys, eventually the price of that particular resource will go up based on supply and demand, and as that buying continues, the store will run out. At this point, the buying price will just keep on increasing. I think there is a maximum value of 265, I believe. That also means that there is no maximum on the selling price. so the seller can just keep going up and up and have the buyers chase him, trying to get as much money as possible. Now, the players who produce that limited resource can try to starve the store out to keep pushing the price up, but eventually they'll have to sell to somebody so the colony doesn't collapse. Because remember, you're trying to produce as much for yourself, but also keep the colony going as well, so everybody doesn't lose. Once all four auctions are done, the scores are recalculated and displayed. And then the process begins again. After 12 rounds, or months, the mothership returns, and the winner is determined, if any. If the total worth of the colony is less than $60,000, then all the players lose and are sent home to work in a mule factory. What I've described is the complete or tournament game. There's also a beginner game, which lasts for only 6 months, has no land auctions or sales, no Christite mining or assays, is a lot more forgiving in terms of the resources that you need, and finally has no losing conditions. The standard game is similar to the tournament game, but has no Christite mining or assays. And there is one other change in the tournament game which I didn't really get into, and that is collusion. Two players can decide to shut out the other players in an auction so they only deal with each other. And there's a little tricky timing that goes on there with hitting the joystick buttons at the same time. Now what this does is allow you to do a land exchange. So for example, if you both ended up with plots of land that are not so good for you, but would work for the other player. And this is, remember earlier I said how you recover from getting the wrong plot of land during the land grab. Or, even better, you could work together to shut out the currently winning player from a food auction so that you two can trade food, but he starves. Very nasty. So that's pretty much the game of Mule. I will return with some thoughts on strategy and general impressions after this.
Warning. The following information is classified top secret. Well, okay, that's not true, but we think it's cool just to tell you that. The subject of this dossier is Random Signal, a podcast produced from an underground super ultra mondo secret facility located somewhere in the Durham, North Carolina area of the mid-Atlantic United States. Its host is Jason Adams, codenamed Kryptonaut, called by some as a rebel, a geek, and a spitting image of Jane from Joss Whedon's Firefly. Random Signal is a podcast for the independent musician, offering a platform for music too good for the mainstream music industry. More data can be obtained on the Random Signal at randomsignal.com. It is your mission to fill your podcatching client with many episodes of Random Signal, a podcast that is so totally Airwolf that Ernest Borgnine is starting up a Backstreet Boys tribute band just so he can get an interview on it. Subscribing to Random Signal is your first priority. End of file.
Before I get into the strategy and kind of the game review, I thought I'd give a little bit of historical framework here. In 1981, Galaga and Ms. Pac-Man came out. In 1982, Qbert was released. That was a big deal. It was a 3D game. Actually, it was 2.5D, but we won't go there. And Tron was released as well. And as well as the biggest disaster in console history, the Atari version of E.T., 1983, which is when Mule came out, produced Spy Hunter, Dragon's Lair, and Star Wars. And that's the stand-up console version with the vector graphics. While these are classics, well, except for E.T., they're not exactly known for their depth. This game, on the other hand, is astonishingly deep for a game of this time period. And maybe even now. Looking at it, there's some pretty simple gameplay here, and it produces some rather complex interactions. So, taking all of that in that context, it's no wonder it showed up as number 3 on at least one all-times games list. Admittedly, that was from 1998, but still. And Sid Meier and Will Wright, who are no slouches themselves, are fans of the game as well. There is a lot to think about in this game. First of all, as I mentioned earlier, you'll want to get your plots near each other, and building similar items near each other so you can maximize your output. Of course, you also want to develop the right resources on the right plot. Producing energy on a river plot is a bit of a waste, or food on a mountain plot for that matter. Now, you could try to go for depth and build lots of one type of a resource, or go for breadth and diversify. It seems like it's better to work together with another player, or maybe two other players, and each go deep into different resources. You'll both make more money that way, because you can maximize your output in that, and then just sell it. This also allows you to basically go deep in two resources. So, for example, you could work with another player, say, look, I'll produce the energy, you produce the food, we will trade back and forth, and then we'll compete equally on the crystite and the ore. If that was all there was to it, that would probably be fun, but I don't know if it would be groundbreaking. What adds a whole new depth to the game is the auction, I think, because this is where the real action in the game is. By carefully controlling the market, this is where you truly maximize your profit. For example, you could buy up all the food in the store, producing a shortage, which will push up the buying price for the food. Then you hold back on selling food until the price gets high enough. Of course, this could go terribly wrong for you. For example, someone else can sell food to the store, which would defeat your strategy. Or, by doing that, you're screwing all the other players, which will lower the total value of the colony and could lead to a loss on your part. One player in our game tried to do something similar with Smith Ore by buying up mules and then letting them go, thereby driving up the price of Smith Ore. It did work for a while. I'm not sure if that would work as a long-term strategy, though. Again, when the other players start selling Smith Ore, you're out of luck. Intuitively, I did notice that he was doing that, and I just sold a little bit of Smith Ore. Not so much that the price would go up terribly, but enough so that there would be mules there that I could use to mine my resources. Similarly, you could be a crystite speculator. You could buy it while the price is low, and then either just do that, or on top of that, you could produce tons of crystite and then sell it all when it's high. Now, note that in this case, you can't create shortfalls of crystite. The price will slowly raise through the game and will peak and fall off somewhere close to the end. And the other thing is that you also have to manage your money carefully because, you need the money to buy the crystite. So all of this in mind, you have to time that speculation carefully. Land is key. Early on in the game, you'll want to spend like mad to get land, and make sure that when the land grab comes around, you get the plots you need to get ahead. This actually brings up one of the shortfalls in the game in my mind. It felt like sometimes when you selected a plot, or tried to select a plot anyway, you could easily miss it on one side or the other, and it goes by pretty darn fast. And it wasn't just me, the other players were having trouble too, and I had trouble in the single-player version as well. In all fairness, this might actually be a problem with the emulator we were using. Perhaps either it was running a shade too fast, or the input mechanism just wasn't pulling fast enough. But still, this was very, very annoying. I actually did come up with a scheme which would work with multiple monitors, where you could select a plot that was available, and then if no one else wanted it, you got it. Again, there'd be the timer counting down, so if you didn't get the plot you wanted, you'd have to quick run to another one and select that one. But obviously that wouldn't work in the original game because there was only one display to work from. But despite all that trouble, I did manage to recover from my mistakes. Others, unfortunately, did not. I guess I had a little bit more practice working with that emulator. Now, I can't say I've found all the strategies here. This is a game that I've heard a lot about probably for the past, 10 years now, and only now have I gotten around to playing it just for this podcast. So, I've only played it a handful of times and only once against humans, but it seems to be the sort of game that varies depending on who you're playing against. A reckless opponent who sells like mad could screw up all your plans, some of the ways that I've described. Or, on the other hand, you might be up against a cautious opponent who just makes you sweat for the resources you need. Or you could be working with someone who is working with you on the early part of the game and then just backstabs you and screws you out of the resources you need later on. I did mention that there's that food-energy strategy where you produce the food and the other person produces the energy. There's nothing stopping one of you from not selling those resources at a particularly bad time for the other player. So, as you might guess, I enjoyed this game. Now, at first, that wasn't true. When I originally played the beginner game, I thought it felt kind of flat. It fell short of many of the auction games that I've played. It was okay, but not really exciting. I just didn't understand what all the fuss was about. Moving up to the more complex games, the land auction and market strategies in the standard game add quite a lot. And the Christite market is just insane in terms of the amount of money that you can make. The computer player just crushed me by producing Christite. And finally, I think to really get the full enjoyment out of this game, and I've seen this echoed in other places, you have to play against humans. The computer player is just too good at resource management to be interesting. It's kind of, well, it's a little frustrating, actually. And I actually spent a lot of time being annoyed at the computer player, and also at the random events. When playing without humans, you can actually laugh at others' bad luck, and maybe laugh a little bit at your own as well. The auction also seems to make a little bit more sense with the humans. I'm not sure I can explain it any better than that. I guess it's that, at least with humans, you can negotiate. Kind of do the metagame outside the actual mechanics. And there's also the aspect of, you know, moving your thing down and bouncing it up and down and trying to give things. Come on, come on. You know you want to buy it. Which the computer does a little bit, but not as much as the humans. And finally, of course, there is the aspect of playing against your friends and just taking them up against the wall. Now, a number of times throughout this discussion, I mentioned that this game has some similarity to German board games, certain German board games anyway, which is not surprising as Danny Bunton played a lot of board games as a kid. Now, I'm not saying that Danny Bunton played these German board games. This game actually came out before those games came out. So, she's ahead of her time in that respect as well. But that does raise the question, would board game players enjoy it more than, say, another computer game? Well, maybe, maybe not. First of all, there are the random events that can screw you pretty badly at times. If you lose a plot of land because of a random event, I think it's something like your claim wasn't recorded properly in the office. It can set you back a lot, and it's really annoying. That one's a little too hurtful. And I'm not sure that your average designer game player would put up with that one. Secondly, the auction is pretty wonky. It's action-oriented. You don't go around and turn and make your bids. Not terribly thoughtful. And you can lower your bid after you make it. So that's a rather different dynamic than the other games, as I've described. The game also has very much an action element to it. For I mentioned that in the auction, there's also that running around on the board and placing your mules. And screwing up because you can't use your joystick properly, it may not be seen as fun by people who are looking for more of a cerebral game. I think if you're a fan of the big box themed American games, that you're going to like this one more than someone who likes the more austere German games. Fans of modern art or of Medici shouldn't expect that kind of gameplay here. However, if you can put up with all of that, I think it's worth it. We played it more than an hour with no complaints, and would have played longer if the server hadn't crashed. Now, we are all video game players, as well as board game players. But still, we'll probably try it again. It is a bit long for lunchtime. It looked like we were going to run into maybe the hour and a half mark. So, we might try it with a beginner game, because it's only 6 turns. But, I don't know. I think missing a lot of the resource management will kind of suck, and the aspect of having you know, everybody lose as well. But we'll see how it goes. Which brings up the game. How did we play it, and how did the session go? The best emulation setup I found, and this is the one that we used, is on a site called Atari Mule Online. Yeah, of course, I'll put that in the show notes. With that comes a set of batch files and an Atari emulator that gets you up and running quickly. With this setup, best of all, you can play a networked four-player. And that's what we did. We did a quick play over lunch at work, and it went pretty well. Actually, it's funny, two of the players chose the beginner player, so they had a quick advantage to start out with. And I think, as it turned out, one of them ended up winning the game. I ended up having... I almost won the game, but due to that and some other bad luck that I had, like I think there was a gambling debt that I had to pay off, just came a little bit short. I think it was like $63 or something like that. And unfortunately, the game kind of ended abruptly at turn 8 when everybody dropped. I'm not sure the emulator is quite as stable as one might like, but it is a nice and easy way of playing the game, and a lot of fun. Oh, in addition to emulators, there have been a handful of clones of Mule, but I frankly haven't had the time to play them, so really can't comment on their quality at all. However, one of them is called Space Horse, and that one comes highly recommended by a number of sites. So I will include a link in the show notes if you want to go look at that. So, that is Mule, an early gaming classic, and in my opinion, well worth your time, so go check it out. I'll be back with some feedback right after this.
Here's the top 10 reasons to listen to The Dice Tower, a podcast all about board games. Number 10, if you're listening to this, then you probably dig top 10 lists, and there's one in every episode. Number 9, it's way edgier than NPR. Number 8, you don't want to be the last person in your gaming group to know about Moritz Eggert and Rick Thornquist's gaming news. Number 7, Tom's soothing voice has been proven to lower stress levels in lab monkeys by 63%. Number 6, you can never have too many contributors, and the Dice Tower features at least 5 every week. Number 5, it's the only way to find out whether Tom Vassell is really that positive. Number 4, you can feel like a globetrotter without having to actually fly to Korea. Number 3, unlike your favorite TV show, you can count on a new episode every week. Number 2, you can say you were there at the beginning after it becomes a massive global phenomenon. And number 1 reason to listen to The Dice Tower, you'll finally be able to put a voice to those 4,921 game reviews you read online. So come out and join us at www.thedicetower.com and listen to our weekly episode of The Dice Tower. We'll see you there.
Okay, starting off with the feedback, I first have a Skype voicemail from Walt O'Hara, also known as Mr. Niz. So, give a listen.
Hi, Jim. Walt O'Hara here. Just as a suggestion, you might want to consider doing a Vintage Gamer podcast on one or several of the metagaming micro games that came out from, I guess, 79 to 82. I did a rather long series of articles, or a retrospective or a nostalgia piece or something, on my blog if you want some background. http://mrnizz.blogspot.com. That's mrniz.blogspot.com. Thanks. Bye.
Thanks, Walt. I actually have some shows planned at some point to discuss Ogre, GEV, and Warp War, which are all in the metagaming series. I might even get to the Fantasy Trip, which is the melee and I think it's Wizard and all that as well, but that will take some work on my part to track those down. I think I'd rather do the easier ones, or rather I should say the ones I already have first. But thanks, that's an excellent suggestion. I did have a number of comments on the Acquire podcast, Walt O'Hara, had some nice things to say about it and a plug for it on his blog, which I appreciate. On the website, Ian Chain, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, says, "Thanks for an excellent show. I wish you'd extend forwards in time to do more recent games too, but either way, please keep up the good work." Well, Ian, as I said on the site, I will be doing some reviews of games based on what I play at Origins, and odds are most of those will be new games. I'm hoping to check out Kalos and Turn in Taxes, for example. I might do the same at Dragon Con as well, but for the most part I know my niche and I'll stick to it. And as I mentioned in the very first podcast, I will probably never do any reviews of modern computer games, simply because that is the industry that I work in, and so there is a bit of conflict of interest there. For example, my review of Tom Clancy's Lockdown would be best game ever. Going back to the site, Miguel writes, "Any chance you will do a show on West End's Paranoia on one of your RPG shows?" Again, I responded to this on the site, but I do think it's worth mentioning. I'm considering it, but due to any lack of gaming group right now, it's going to be tough to put that one together. I think I also need to get a copy of the original version. We, my wife and I, have the latest edition, but it's hardly vintage unless you look back a bit, like to the original, eh? Finally, Planet Heidi also says on the site, "Mule, I'm super excited about the next podcast in Mule. I still have my original 5 1/4 floppy and packaging from the 80s. Well, Planet Heidi, here it is, and I hope you liked it. If you have feedback for the Vintage Gamer on this show or any other, you can leave comments on the website, which is www.thevintagegamer.net, or you can contact me directly via email at vintagejim@gmail.com or via Skype. My username there is JVSquare. Or you can try my shiny new voicemail number at 1-206-350-8684. That's 1-206-350-VNTG. Feedback is always welcome. And thus concludes yet another Out of This World episode of The Vintage Gamer. Our theme is performed by the trio Music of the Spheres and available on the album of the same name at magnatune.com. Your humble host is Jim Van Verth. The next episode of The Vintage Gamer will probably be an Origins report, but I may squeeze another one in before then. Until then, keep trying those new games, but don't forget to play the old ones. Thanks for listening.